With us, we have a standard rule that we don't charge for any haircuts you don't want. So when anyone's coming in to have their hair shaved off because chemo's kicking in, or they're bringing a wig in that they want us to cut and shape and style, we don't charge for that because they don't want to pay for it. We don't want to take money off them. You know, we want to just make it, we want them to know that, you know, we're in their corner and we're part of their support system. I mean, as a creative, you kind of trust your gut a lot. You know, I think a lot of my business acumen is made up on the spot. And it's a gut instinct. I think you feel it and see it from people. The cost of starting a small business and how long it took before you broke even, saw a profit. a long time. Welcome to The Noble Barber. This is a podcast for barbers by barbers, cutting through the crap of the industry. We all want to know how our businesses can run better. I want to talk to people who've done it, messed it up and got it right second time round, and can tell us the way that you and I can make our businesses better. Hi, and welcome to the latest edition of the Noble Barber podcast. As you can see, I'm on my own on this one. We've had a very last minute cancellation. And so I've just put a shout out to friends, staff and other people to bing me in some questions. So this is just me and I'll be reading as I go. So bear with me. The first one comes maybe. So how did you start your first business? Was it a success? What process did you have to go through to start something on your own? So yes, my first business wasn't a success. It kind of seemed to go quite well. I was in a partnership that was quite messy. I was very young and didn't really quite get it. And I think my first huge learn is of starting a business is do your background checks, make sure that the people you're getting into business are sound. You know, I mean, my business partner was a friend, but the paperwork was all a bit iffy. I didn't see it through. I did a lot of it on trust and a handshake. And so that didn't work. I then set up straight away completely on my own. That was really successful for a good 20 years, which we closed down 12 years ago. And then I started this new one, which is the most fun I've had, if I'm honest. What would I have done differently? The store was huge. We had a kind of 3,000 square foot mega store with beauty rooms and hairdressers and a coffee shop and a retail room. And we had that whole kind of thing. And I'm not sure it ever sat brilliantly well with me. I'd have always been happier doing the boutique stores that we've got now. Even then we wanted to do more than one. I think my ambition was always to have more than one shop. And with that business, although the store itself was very successful and I trained my first hairdressers there and we had some great times, we never managed to kind of spread it into a second store. So yeah, I'd definitely do something different, definitely. How did I start in hairdressing? Mine was really accidental. Mine was very accidental. I desperately wanted to get into fashion design. I was I've always been interested in fashion. Kid of the 80s, that it was a great time for men to be able to kind of explore fashion. And where I grew up, it wasn't that fashionable. So I spent a lot of time in the West End clubbing and partying and meeting the great and the beautiful. And then I just found that actually, you know, my segue into it was through hairdressing. Hairdressing salons in the 80s were great fun. And I was lucky to work with, you know, some great people, you know, in Knightsbridge and around the West End. So, you know, it was a very, very accidental time. I think the skill gave me one thing, but I think it was very much being in that crowd of people. I needed to be around people that were a bit more creative and inventive. How have barbershops changed more recently? Yeah, they have. I guess more recently is about the last decade or, you know, around that decade and a half. Yeah, I think everyone's just got really confident about what the industry is. I think we've got really, really ballsy with what we're doing. I think men are really aware of their look now and want to embrace it. And I think as barbers, we've got much more confident to do our own thing and to shout it out. And I think you kind of walk and see the amount of different stores you get out there. It shows there's such a diversity, there's such an interest. And from doing this podcast and reaching out to a variety of people, I'm realizing just how far-reaching our industry is, and all the amazing people and things that are in there. I guess the recollection really is, I always thought about the kind of barbershop when I was a kid, and it was just filled with old men smoking. and that, I guess, is maybe a bit of a kind of old memory that fades badly. Whereas, you know, barbershops, certainly the last decade or so, are just great places to hang out. They've become clubs, and we're seeing so much more inventiveness from us. How about the landlord topic? What do you look out for with a good contract? And then I've also got, how do you decide on a space? How's the right location for your business? So maybe they can go together. I think finding the right place is a bit of gut instinct. I think I find areas that I've liked, and then I spend a lot of time there. I suddenly start getting my coffee in that place. I suddenly start shopping there. I talk to the other shopkeepers and get a bit of an idea of the area. This year, we were planning to open up a couple of stores over in Fulham and spent a lot of time looking around there. And actually, while it was going on, different traffic issues happened. Wandsworth Bridge was closed. They've changed the parking. And actually, the street I was looking at has suddenly become, you know, all the shopkeepers in there are complaining that their business is down by 20%. And so I guess I was kind of saved that problem by not going there. But we're looking at other areas, and I'll do the same. I will suddenly start drinking coffee and buying my papers and my donuts and coffee in a new area to be announced. Landlords, I mean, I think over the years I've had some good and I've had some bad. I've not had any indifferent. They seem to be either really good and really bad. There's, your solicitor or lawyer will definitely tell you that your contract is good or bad. But I've always tried really hard to have a good relationship with landlords. So I've reached out, I try and be communicating with them. And overall, I've had more good than bad. You know, I've had one or two that are a little bit more aggressive. But overall, I think, I mean, as a creative, you kind of trust your gut a lot. You know, I think a lot of my business acumen is made up on the spot. And it's a gut instinct. I think you feel it and see it from people. Landlords are a difficult one to tell. And you never really know until you're in it, unfortunately. How do you talk about the business? Oh, gosh, that's a good one. Sorry, I'm reading this as I go. Could you talk about how you balance being a business owner and having a family and a private life? Yeah, I mean, they do overlap quite a lot, I guess. And I think for me, the stores are kind of extension of the family. I like, you know, I think that there is a real overlap. You know, the team really do get involved. And my family have all got involved. My two boys, whether they liked it or not, have both been working in the stores with a broom and helped out. I think my wife's really good at kind of giving me a good nudge or a steely eye when I need to kind of leave things alone a little bit. And, you know, I've been owning businesses for 35 years, nearly 35 next year. And I've known my wife most of that time. So she's quite good at letting me know when it's overreaching. But when a new store's opening or when we're doing something new, it does tend to, it dominates. And I'm very lucky that my wife and the boys kind of get it, and they know that's what I'm about, and are really supportive. And I think the team in the stores are really supportive when there's stuff that is going on for me and my family to support me. So, yeah. I guess the answer to that is I don't separate it very well, I guess, is the answer to that one. Dealing with difficult situations, how to be professional but still stand your ground. Yeah, I guess that's complaints, isn't it? I think as soon as you become a business owner, you find you're in difficult situations. And I do a lot of, never done that before. Yeah, and I don't think you always get it right. I think you have to hold your hands up and kind of go, don't always get it right. I am just human and I mess it up, but hopefully I learn and grow from that. I think with complaints from clients, you know when you're wrong, I guess. And just because a client's complaining doesn't necessarily mean that you're wrong. I think it's about that expectation. I think you can explain well, but complaints are difficult, and I think you need to stay calm, staying focused, but you need to be honest that you are where you are, you know, in the same way with, you know, with running the team and running the business, when things change or things go wrong, I think I've learned, my big learn has been that I'm honest with everyone around me that I didn't get that right, or I'm trying to get it right. And I get told by the team a lot what I need to improve upon and what I need to do. How would you talk and approach a consultation with someone undergoing chemotherapy? Yeah, I mean, we spoke about that with Mark Sproston about men and his group that he was doing. It's a very difficult thing. And I think it's the big bit of the industry that really brings out your empathy and makes you realize just how important we are and the job we do when you're cutting hair and making people feel good. I think when you're dealing with something like chemotherapy where the hair's coming off, you know, and you can't make people feel good, I think you can only stay really empathic. It's horrible. It's a horrible thing that the people are going through, but you can be really amazing and look for a way that you can get that empathy across. With us, we have a standard rule that we don't charge for any haircuts you don't want. So when anyone's coming in to have their hair shaved off because chemo's kicking in, or they're bringing a wig in that they want us to cut and shape and style, we don't charge for that because they don't want to pay for it. We don't want to take money off them. You know, we want to just make it, we want them to know that, you know, we're in their corner and we're part of their support system. And then as their hair grows back, you know, we're trimming and shaping and trying to help. But we don't charge for those either because they tend to be kind of fairly poor haircuts while they're growing their hair back. But then there's a point that the hair's back and they look good and they get a style and they love it and then they get a bill. And I think, you know, I think that's what we found our way to get that message across, that we're more than a business. We're kind of, yeah, we're on your side. And I think when you're dealing with something like cancer and chemotherapy, that you want people around you. Yeah, the more people that can be part of the team and help you, the better. And I think it's quite an honor that we get invited in. I think the cost of starting a small business and how long it took before you broke even, saw a profit. a long time. I mean, I think you got to go with your budget. I think, you know, I mean, I think if you've got X amount of money, then that's the sort of big company you're going to build. You know, there's a massive difference between, you know, a £500,000 store and a £10,000 store, but both have their place and both can be done. Recouping that money, yeah, it takes a while. You know, and when we opened up a new store just directly before the COVID lockdown, and actually the whole company ended up with probably more debt after COVID than we had when we first set up. And I guess it's more a matter of managing the debt and staying on top of it. You know, I think a lot of people I've spoken to after nine and a half months of shutdown had debt, whether it was landlord's debt or whether it was money to the revenue or just keeping going. And a lot of people didn't make it and their businesses folded, which was heartbreaking. We were very lucky that we got through, but I think we adapted almost straight back to how it was in the beginning, that we were trying to manage that debt fast. And we kept talking to the people that we owed money to. Yeah. So I think when it's more about managing the debt, and I think you need to look at how much you've got. You know, the first little barbershop we opened up, we set up and built for like 20 grand. and that got busy. And I'd have thought, you know, it probably took us a couple of years to get to clear that small debt. You know, other stores have cost kind of four or five times that amount, and obviously still have some debt to it. But yeah, I think the easiest way for me to think of that more recently is COVID and the debt of that. And I think, you know, as long as you're managing the debt and your business can afford the debt, it's fine. So if you've got a company that you've borrowed on, you know, just make a plan about how you're going to manage the debt and make some profit and get paid. I think making sure you get paid is a really important thing as a salon owner, because that can get forgotten really easily. How do you go from one shop to more without losing quality? How do you take your team along for the journey? And why have you only got small shops and not big ones? The honesty of my wife. So from one to two was really interesting. I think as soon as you have more than one building, you have to trust. And I think my big learn of having, you know, the group that we've got now has been about really trusting the people around me. I'm not a great micromanager. I don't like jumping all over people. I like people to feel trusted and to be able to kind of prove themselves. And I think the big one for me was really kind of that learning that trust and keeping my hands off. Initially, lots and lots of conversation. And even now, actually, we have now brought a really good structure to our managers' meetings and we come together to talk through stuff. You know, there's the trust. And I think quality is the people that you surround yourself with. You know, the people around me certainly make me keep my quality high and vice versa. So I think the people that we attract to the company keep our quality really, really where it wants to be. And a lot of trust. The team come on the journey. I think they quite enjoy it. I think it's when we're not doing stuff that the team can get a bit bored. So I think I'm really lucky that the team will kind of jump on board with the idea and run with it. And, you know, I'm very lucky. They're really good people. But I think, again, it's that communicating, that talking about it. It's trying to be as honest and transparent as you possibly can be. And I think that's been the biggest learn for me since we opened up the new company and opened up more stores, was that transparency. You know, you don't need, as a salon owner or barbershop owner or a store owner, or as I kind of always think of myself as a shopkeeper, you don't need to worry about what other people think. You need to be encouraging people to be part of it. And what are the problems with expanding when you're a control freak? How did you learn to delegate? Yeah, I think when I started the first one, and certainly with my previous company, I was much more, it was vital that I stayed really in control. I think I was learning myself how to be a salon owner, you know, how to own a shop, how to be the boss. And I think I was trying very hard not to be like some bosses and very hard to be like some bosses. So I think it takes a little while for you to find your own skin. And then once you do, you've got to have that layer of confidence to share it and be open about who you are. So I think the control freak kind of tends to go the more you start being honest and explaining yourself and asking for help. And I think that's been a really big one that's really helped for me. How do you manage negative reviews? How does that reflect on your staff, Facebook, TikTok? Does it matter? And the wider community? Yeah. I mean, yes, it does, of course. I mean, reviews are vital, and, you know, and we all love it. And when you get a good review, you know, it's like, you know, pinning a medal on your chest. And, you know, I think, you know, it's not just the company that gets excited when we get new good reviews. I think the teammate themselves that's mentioned in it gets a great buzz, and you can see that rise in their esteem. It's lovely. So, you know, reviews are really important. Bad reviews, I mean, I guess, you know, it's lovely to always be told you're great, apparently. but, you know, if you get stuff wrong, you get stuff wrong. You know, I mean, I think, as I said, I think when you're, if a complaint's justified, then all you can do is hold your hands up. And if you get a bad review, you know, that's justified, I think you should answer it truthfully and hold your hands up. You know, it went wrong. Someone was off their A game. You know, come back, show that actually it's unusual for that sort of stuff to happen. I think when it's not, when you have someone ranting, I remember having someone complaining very heavily because their mother-in-law had brought their son in for a haircut and cut his long blonde locks off, short back and sides, and laid into one of my barbers about it. And that's not a justified complaint. It's insane. You know, it's nothing to do with us. That's a family issue. So I kind of like that. You can still be a bit humorous if it's an online review that's gone up. You know, I kind of love those the response to those reviews when you're being a bit more humorous. So I think you've got a way with your reviews to always get that message over of who you are. Facebook, TikTok, I mean, social media is a huge part. And I think, if you can get your message over, I don't think it's something that I'm really that great at. I think as a store, it's a conversation I have with all of us all the time. And I don't think we've nailed it yet. I think we're trying still to find out how we get our style over. And I think that's what you need to take more time out, is to what you're trying to say on social media. I think getting involved with the community, you are, and I think as a barbershop or a hair salon, that you are part of that community. People migrate to you. You know, you're part of people's network. And so the more you reach out to the other shops, the other stores, you know, and I think doing this has really encouraged me to kind of wander into other shops. So I walk into other barbers and have a chat about what's going on. You know, I was in Porto with my wife and a few friends last month, and I walked past the most beautiful barbershop ever in the back of a back road. And I went in and had a chat with this guy who spoke very little English. My Portuguese is appalling. But he'd been there 50, 60 years. And we had a really good chat and explained who I was and why I wanted to talk to him. And I've do that a lot. So I think I love my local community around the stores. But equally, I think our industry and our industry community is bangingly good. I love it. And I've never yet... I might get the odd look when I wander into a barber's that I've spotted and start having a chat, but I generally always end up with a good, positive conversation. So I think reaching out to the arena is a good thing. And then I guess a good one to finish on is another one from my wife, which is, will I ever retire? I don't know if that means she wants me to retire and wants more of me around, or she doesn't want me to. I don't know. I don't think so. I love what I do. I'm really excited. I get really enthusiastic. I'm probably more energized now than I was in my 20s about it. I think in my 20s, I was really having to kind of learn, or I was trying to pretend who I was. I'm a salon owner, and I had this kind of image or idea that I had. And I think now I'm really excited. I love that I've got teammates that I work with that dictate to me, and they want me to be in a different role in my company. They don't necessarily want me to be the boss. They need to be the boss, and they want to slot me in their team for other skills. So yeah, I think I might wind it down a little bit, but no, I can't see me leaving this industry alone. I thoroughly enjoy it. So my wife is safe and sound. I hope this has been okay. It's very odd not having anyone to talk about and to talk to, and very odd to just chat. I hope there's been some interesting things in this, and hopefully we can get some guests back on soon. Thank you. Thank you for watching this episode of The Noble Barber. If you liked it, please do like and subscribe. If you've got comments of what we should be doing in future, please give us your questions and we'll try and find an expert to talk to. Or if you're the expert and you want to come on here and help, stay in touch, we'll get you on. Come and join us on the sofa.